Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Could nut trees provide staple food for humanity? That's at the heart of Elspeth Hay's new book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. She takes us on a journey not only delving into that question, but the myths that we have come to believe about farming and staple foods. Elspeth also is CAI's local food reporter. Welcome. So good to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. So I had no idea that humans could eat acorns. So talk a little bit about how you learned this and how that kind of upended what you believed about food and farming.
Yeah, I had no idea either until about, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, a friend sent me an email saying, you've got to check out this TED, I think it was a TEDx talk. And it was by a woman in Greece named Marcy Mayer, and she was an expat from California. And she said, people can eat acorns. Acorns are a superfood and actually one of humanity's oldest staple foods. And I looked out my window in Wellfleet at this oak forest all around me that I had always seen as sort of an impediment to food production, really, because, you know, it's all part of the Cape Cod National Seashore and it can't be cleared. And I thought, wait, what? All along, this has been food that's falling on my roof and all over my yard. And I was just totally shocked.
I think a lot of us, right, didn't know this. So what I love about this book makes it really interesting is that you take us along on this journey of discovery. We go along with you. Was that the idea you started with?
Well, it started out not even really as an idea of a book. I was going to write a cookbook. I've been doing recipes and local food cooking for a long time. And I was working on this cookbook and I was in conversation with an editor in Vermont. And she said, you know, don't do a cookbook unless you're really famous. It's kind of pointless. It's really hard. And then we were about to hang up and she was like, oh, what are you up to these days? And I was like, oh, I've gotten really into acorns. It's fascinating. I had no idea you could eat them. And we started talking about it. And by the time we were about to hang up, she said, you got to write that book.
There's your book. Right?
Yeah. Tell us this story. So that was how it started out. But actually getting that story that was in my head out onto a piece of paper took a very long time.
Yeah. So before we get into the journey, what does an acorn taste like? You can't just pop them in your mouth.
No, you can't. Acorns, just like olives, have tannins, which are these incredibly bitter compounds. And they need to be processed in the same way as olives, actually. So it seems like a bit of a pain that you have to get these tannins out. But olives are, you know, we've all managed to eat olives. We're doing pretty well with those as a staple crop. So they're water soluble. So you have to use water to get the tannins out. And once you do that, acorns are very mild. I've heard someone call them the tofu of the nut world. And it's kind of great because what you make out of acorns a lot of the time, not always, which we can get into, is flour. And you don't really want flour to have a super strong flavor because it's a background.
Right. All right. So the oak tree in lots of cultures is known as the tree of life. So you kind of bring us back to, as this woman had said, this has been around for a long, long time. Somehow we forgot.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I first started. You know, I heard, okay, we can eat acorns. And she claimed that they had been this superfood. And I thought, really? I don't know. So I started looking back through the histories of a lot of different cultures and discovered that, in fact, all over the Northern Hemisphere, in this incredibly large range of cultures, places in Japan, places in China, Korea, all over Europe, a lot of places in North America, even down into Northern Africa, the Mediterranean, acorns had been this staple crop. So, you know, a staple crop is something today. It's like corn or soybeans or wheat, these really important everyday foods. And that was true in a lot of places until a few hundred years ago. So it's actually a pretty recent thing that we got separated from these foods. I found some, I think it was Pliny, who was writing about the Roman relationship with acorns. Which they included actually beech nuts, which are another edible tree nut in the same family, in with acorns. But he said basically, yeah, everyone eats those. Yeah. Everyone knows that.
And I thought this was interesting that at one time, oak savannas covered 27 to 32 million acres in the Midwest. And by 1985, fewer than 6,500 acres remained. So what happened?
So the oak savannas that were historically in the Midwest of the present-day United States were created by indigenous people through burning. So they're this incredibly human-produced landscape, and one that I think a lot of people see as wild or natural, but actually that was produced intentionally as a foodscape. So a place just like a farm that would produce food.
Yeah. And then they were replaced?
Well, as European colonization moved west and pushed indigenous people out of their traditional homelands, the European model was to replace that oak savanna land with row crops and farmland. And that wasn't just because that was what settlers and the colonial model wanted. It was also because that was what was incentivized by the U.S. government. So when under the Homestead Act, you know, indigenous land was taken and then given to Euro-American settlers, there was a stipulation, and I don't remember the exact details, but basically you had to farm it for 5 years in order to get title to the land. Mm. So you couldn't just keep it, even if you wanted to, you couldn't keep it in oak savanna and keep that method of food production going. You had to transition it to a Euro-American style row crop farm, you know, growing the crops that today we know as staple foods and farm crops. Yeah. So there was a really systematic land change that happened at that time.
You get a little upset about that in the book too.
It was very upset. Violent.
Yeah.
And something that I think, violence is one thing, and then to layer a sort of erasure of that violence on top of the violence, I think becomes very traumatic both for the perpetrators and the people who experience the violence.
Mark Shepard, you went to a talk, Mark Shepard was at, and you could tell us about him, but he worked on what he called restoration agriculture. So tell us what that is and what you found when you visited his farm.
Okay, so to tell that story, I'm going to back up
a little bit. Yeah.
When I was a kid, my parents were bird watchers, and I spent a lot of time going around Maine with them, which is where I grew up. They were writing this book at the time, A Birdwatcher's Guide to the Coast of Maine, and my sister and I sort of reluctantly got dragged around everywhere looking at birds, and we would go to all these different habitats, right, all these different ecosystems. And everywhere we went, my parents would spend a lot of time telling us the ways that the different species of birds were perfectly adapted to these habitats. And, you know, like the sapsuckers drilled these neat little rows of holes in the maples and birches. And then we would leave these hikes or excursions and go to the grocery store where the food came from industrial farms and go make our meals. And I remember thinking, like, what is wrong with us? You know, what is wrong with our species? Why do all these other species have a habitat and a place in the world? And we have to kind of create these artificial places just in order to feed ourselves. So that was kind of always there in the background. And so when a friend said, oh, this guy Mark Shepard is coming to town, and I think I had told them about the acorn thing, and they were like, you should go to this talk. I think you'll like this. And I had never heard of Mark Shepard, but I went and I sat in the back of this classroom at Nauset Regional High School. And he started out with kind of that same story that I had absorbed as a kid. You know, our agriculture is the leading cause of environmental devastation. We take these ecosystems where all our needs could be met and we plow them up and we wash them out to sea. And I thought, wait, what? What ecosystem where all our needs can be met? We do have a habitat. I'm ready to hear more. And so he was describing the oak savanna and these ecosystems that once existed all through the area that we call farm country today in the United States. And he had this list of the species that are in an oak savanna. And it was an incredible list. It was chestnuts and oak trees and grapes and asparagus and plums, raspberries, gooseberries, blueberries, hazelnuts, you know, deer for venison, quail, rabbits. Just this incredible list that I thought, wow, if I could eat cornmeal or all those things, I would definitely pick all those things. That sounds pretty great. And so he took a plot of super eroded, kind of devastated farmland that he bought in 1996 in Wisconsin. And he decided that he was going to plant a farm that mimicked this oak savanna ecosystem. And today I went out to visit a couple years after going to this talk, and he's got, at the time I was there, he had 139 edible perennial species. Yeah, plants that just come back and keep on producing. And it was pretty cool to see. He had, you know, he was producing all this food. He was selling to the Organic Valley Co-op, and he also had an endangered species that had just shown up on the farm. So he was doing this really cool hybrid work of restoring the land with farming.
Yeah. And so you look at the history of trees, particularly nut trees, and the question that you're trying to answer, now you visited Mark's farm, you've heard him say this, is could nut trees feed the world? And that's sort of the question of the book that you keep. And the answer is yes.
Yeah, the answer surprised me. I have always heard or understood through the history that I had learned in school that, you know, most people used to be hunter-gatherers, and then we underwent the agricultural revolution because we needed to feed more people. And once we became farmers and our numbers started growing, hunting and gathering didn't produce enough food, and that's why we became farmers, right? I think most of us...
And it's not true.
No, it's not true, but that's what most of us learned in school. And so I had to do a lot of work to re-educate myself and to, I think, convince myself that it's not true, because these little questions kept popping up and I was definitely skeptical.
And there's a lot more visits to farms we're going to talk about in this. And each farm, learn something more. And after the break, we're going to talk about your trip to California, which is just mind-blowing. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking with Elspeth Hay about her new book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Elspeth Hay about her new book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, you go to California and you visit with Ron Reed, who's a Karuk medicine man, cultural biologist, and indigenous activist. And boy, was that a learning experience.
It was. I got to know Ron during the early pandemic, and we spent a lot of time on Zoom just talking about acorns and getting to know each other and building some trust, because there, you know, there is a lot of historic distrust between indigenous communities often and Euro-American communities for good reason. So we spent a long time getting to know each other, and after a few years, he said, you know, what if you came out and saw this place? And I was pretty excited and got on a plane to the Klamath region of present-day California. So that's Northern California. And what Ron had been telling me about was the fact that his people have traditionally cared for oak trees with fire. So the ecosystem of the Northern Klamath is an oak grassland ecosystem. And without fire, it tends to get really overgrown with Douglas fir trees, which are highly flammable and which also use a lot of water. So what we're seeing now in California, because, you know, my only real reference point for fire in California was that I'd been hearing about the wildfires, as we all have. So, you know, I thought of fire as destructive and bad. And when I first started getting to know Ron, he kept telling me fire is medicine. And I didn't really know what that meant. But when I went out there, I was able to go on a field trip with a group going up into this sort of overgrown tan oak stand. So tan oaks are the oaks out there that they use as this food crop. And they're these incredible trees, just huge trunks covered in moss. And this stand that we hiked up to was full of what they called legacy trees. So the legacy trees were these really old tan oaks that had been allowed to open grow in a place where, you know, in a time when they were taking care of the land with fire regularly. So doing these prescribed burns basically to keep the woods open. So not these super dense canopies filled with the conifers and other species choking out the oaks, but almost like an oak you would see in a park, right? With those wide reaching limbs and just this beautiful form. And so what had happened there is that these traditional Karuk way of tending the oak forest, which they did through ceremony. And so each year they hold these world renewal ceremonies, which they say are medicine for the land to keep the earth in balance and to pray for all living things. And they do that by lighting fires in strategic places in the area. And so when Euro-Americans took, you know, all of their ancestral land, I think it was 1.4 million acres. I might get that number a little bit wrong, but it's a huge area that once encompassed all these Karuk villages and hunting grounds and gathering areas. And that was made part of the U.S. Forest Service. So under the control of the U.S. government, which, as we know, still pursues a policy of fire suppression. So this traditional way of caring for the land became illegal. And today, what I saw when I went out there was these beautiful old tan oaks now just completely getting choked out by Douglas firs. And what the group that I was with was doing was they were working with a huge different number of government agencies, tribal agencies, nonprofits, and they're working to bring the land back to a place where fire can be put on it again. So if you just light fire again in one of these tan oak stands, the Douglas firs would go mm-hmm. up and the whole place would burn down.
Right.
So they were kind of clearing out some of the Douglas firs and trying to walk it back to a place where it could be cared for with the traditional fire.
Yeah.
So it was pretty amazing to see firsthand what he meant when he said fire is medicine, and to understand that some of these, you know, when we see these wildfires today, they're not just, we say, oh, they're because of climate change, or oh, you know, it's just getting hotter. And yes, that is true, and that is part of it, but it's also because of mismanagement and because people haven't been able to care for the land in the way that it needs to be cared for. I got to see that.
And you walked away with kind of a different, you were mad.
Yeah.
Mad at what happened to these people.
I mean, yeah, I think that I was always told as a kid that when Euro-American settlers showed up, you know, there were a few people here, but because of disease, which was really tragic, most indigenous communities weren't present anymore. And that is so false and such a false narrative. And the erasure of that violence, I think, is really harmful, very harmful for Indigenous communities who are, you know, actively still trying to say, hey, we're still here. We know how to take care of this place. This is our land. But also harmful for Euro-American communities who don't know the history of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that any kind of land repair, I think, also involves human repair.
Yeah. So you returned from California, and unfortunately, you got time to think, but you get this rash on your face. Poison ike or poison oak or ivy or something. Boy, I could feel for you as you were describing what you're going through. But you can't sleep, so you're thinking a lot, right? And one of the things that you're thinking about is farmers versus foragers or hunter-gatherers. And you kind of take this deep dive into that question, what is the difference between gathering and farming? And this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I think I had always thought of hunting and gathering as this historic practice that was pretty different from farming. You know, the classic, I have a friend who was describing it, who said, yeah, you know, you wake up in the morning and you think, ooh, I wonder what I'm going to find out there today. Like, what am I going to see? And there's a really great book called Tending the Wild by an author named Kat Anderson, who really details the ways that Indigenous people in California have cared for the land there. And it, you know, it was a lot of the same stuff that Ron Reed was telling me. And he had been telling me all the different uses of fire on the landscape. So fire was used as a fertilizer because when you do these prescribed burns, these nutrients that are sort of laying in the detritus layer on top of the forest are broken back down and returned to the soil. So it gives this fertilization nutrient boost. Fire was used as pest control. So acorns, if anyone's ever cracked open an acorn, you may have found an acorn weevil, which is a cute little maggot-like worm that you might not want to find in your dinner.
People might not call it cute. But
yeah,
okay.
Well, I don't know. Kids love them. Kids are totally into the acorn weevils. But no, not what you want to find in your dinner. And so the smoke from the fire actually keeps the beetles that produce these acorn weevils in check. So it's a, you know, works against pests.
Mm-hmm. Fire. Don't need pesticides.
Yeah. Fire was weeding, right? Because these other species grow up that are undesirable in the tan oak cropland. Fire was controlling the water cycle. If you get too many trees on the land, you start to ping pong between these wildfires and going all the way back to bare earth instead of holding the forest in this intermediate stage of succession. So as I started to look at this, and fire also creates a seed bed for the tan oak acorns to really sprout well. And, you know, I was making a list of these jobs and thinking about the jobs involved in farming, right, which is preparing the seed bed, watering, fertilizing, controlling pests and pathogens, weeding, and it's all the same jobs. It's just a different crop and a different culture. And I started looking into the history of some of those words and those terms, because you would think, right, these words are going to be really old because the agricultural revolution supposedly happened 10,000 years ago. So we've got some old language for this, right, for this shift from foraging to farming. And what I found is all the language around that was created in the 1920s and 1930s. And it was created at the same time as this sort of time period of scientific racism that was painting Indigenous people as people of the past and the sort of Euro-American farmer as this person of the present. And I don't know if anyone listening has read The Dawn of Everything by David Wengrow, and there's two Davids. but it's, they sort of talk about the agricultural revolution as the revolution that never happened. And the more I started learning about traditional ways of caring for these tree crops, the more I started to really question that vocabulary.
So David Graeber and David Wegrow, right?
Thank you.
Okay.
Two Davids.
Yeah. So, and then you start to look at yield, right? So when talking with farmers, particularly in the Midwest, why they grow what they grow is based on yield. But what does that mean, really, right? So talk a little bit first about this conversation always going to yield.
Yeah, well, our farmers have to care about yield in the Midwest because that's what our system is designed for them to care about. That's what we're asking them to care about and what we're asking them to produce. You know, the farm system in the U.S. as it is now is heavily subsidized, and that's all based on yield and what you can yield on this one piece of land in terms of food output from this area.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it gets a bit complicated, but looking at yields, which again is a huge consideration, you find that abandoning tree crops has never been about yield.
Yeah, that whole story that I mentioned earlier of this idea that, you know, we were all hunter-gatherers and then we had to become farmers because that didn't produce enough food. That's actually a story that was really carefully crafted during the privatization of a lot of public lands. So we've talked a bit about, Euro-American colonization of indigenous lands in the U.S. But before Euro-Americans came to North America and other places around the globe, there was this internal colonization of England and some of these other European countries where public lands and especially woodlands, wooded areas that had been managed commonly and were available for common use, they were called commons, were enclosed and privatized. And that is something that I didn't know when I started researching all this, because I kept going back trying to figure out, okay, if my ancestors used to worship these trees and think of them as the tree of life and eat from them, what happened? What, you didn't just wake up one day and think, oh, yeah, I don't know, never mind, they're not that great.
Right.
So I was trying to figure out how that disconnect happened. And when I went back, right around the same time as the early colonial period, where, you know, I was always told, oh, our ancestors came here because it was a land of opportunity and they're, you know, it was just exciting, right? But that doesn't really make a lot of sense if you stop and think about it. Why would you leave the place where, I mean, do you want to leave your home for a place where you have to travel months across the ocean and might die just because, oh, it's kind of a cool land of opportunity? I doubt it.
Yeah.
But there was this closing of the woodlands and of common areas and this pretty violent separation of people from land and land from people. And the story that was told, you know, even in Europe during that time, was, they didn't really produce much anyway, that land. And at first, obviously, people didn't believe it because they were in direct relationship with those places. But as time went on and those relationships were severed, I think that story became easier to tell and easier for people to believe. And, you know, for me, I've believed that my entire life. And it wasn't until really going through the facts and digging into it that I started to unravel that.
And that idea of the commons is really interesting too. I mean, people, they had their animals there. It was this shared space, right? And I thought it was really interesting. You visited, and I don't remember which farm this was, where they had the fences made from the chestnut trees and stuff. And the fences were there to keep the animals out, like in a commons, right? It was not to keep things in, it was to keep things out, which was really interesting.
Yeah, that was in Appalachia. I spent some time when I was researching the book visiting all through Appalachia along the Blue Ridge. Because like I said, I kept trying to figure out, okay, where did this rupture happen? How did we get disconnected from these trees? And people kept telling me, oh, you got to go to Appalachia. You got to go there. Because until the chestnut blight, which pretty much wiped out the American chestnut in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s in Appalachia, there were a lot of communities there where chestnuts in particular were still this staple food and this staple tree. So I thought, okay, that's within my grandparents' lifetime. I'm gonna go start there. And I got to know this historian, Ralph Lutz, who was great and took me all over southwestern Virginia looking at this area where the chestnut had once been actually used as a currency in addition to a staple food. So they had these little general stores there, and people would go out and pick up chestnuts in the woods. I mean, the chestnuts were said to be so big it took multiple people to reach around their trunks. These huge, they called them the grandfathers of the forest. And the nuts on the forest floor in the fall would be several inches deep. And he went back through the records of all these old general stores trying to figure out how much the nut harvest really was, because the nuts, people would go gather the nuts and bring them into these general stores, and then they would get sent into the cities, right? You know, like the song, Chestnuts Roasting on the Open Fire. Those chestnuts were coming from these mountain communities and getting sent to the cities. And a lot of the ledgers that he found had been chewed up by mice, so there were some numbers he couldn't get. But they really told the story of people who got most of their spending money from these trees. And as he was showing me that, I thought, okay, that's wow, that's a lot. But then he started telling me, oh yeah, and they didn't own the land. And I said, what? And he said, oh yeah, I mean, most of this land was big holdings owned by people in the cities or by a few wealthy landowners. I think 80% of the people lived on 4% of the land. And what was happening was these were common areas. So if they weren't enclosed by a fence, anyone could turn out their animals to graze or forage. They could go collect nuts. They could hunt. They could fish. They could find medicine. And that was a tradition that people who were escaping the enclosures in Europe had brought here and tried to recreate this common system.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. And going through those histories, you also looked at what happened once the blight came, and you got to really see the change in what happened in that whole region as all those chestnut trees were lost.
Yeah, I met a woman, Peggy Barkley, who was telling me about, you know, her family's memories of the blight. And she said that in that region of southwestern Virginia, the blight happened at the same time as the Great Depression. But for them, the blight was the Great Depression. They didn't have money. You know, they weren't worried about their collapsing stock portfolio. They had nothing to eat. They had lost their source of income, which was the chestnuts, and also the crop that fed all their animals, which was the chestnuts, and also the crop that really fed the people, which was the chestnuts. So it was this incredibly devastating situation.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Elspeth Hay about her book, Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Rand is calling from the Outer Cape. Hi, Rand.
Oh, hello.
Go ahead.
I'm calling from Orleans.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm next to See Hall Bookstore. Elspeth's book.
Oh.
I'm calling because I worked with Mark Shepherd to start the farm in western Wisconsin.
Oh.
And part of a group on Cape Cod called the Food Forest Initiative of Cape Cod. We've done three demonstration projects here, one with Long Pasture Audubon, Wildlife Sanctuary, Demonstration Forest Garden, and we've done one under the power lines in Harwich, with the Water Commission and support from Eversource, so people can walk under the power lines off Bay Road in Harwich and see a project based on restoration agriculture.
I love this. Oh, my gosh. You must have known about this, Elspeth.
I do know. Rand. He's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's so cool. Give us an example of some of the stuff you're growing there.
Well, we came up with a species list. Mark Shepherd came and did a workshop with us before we did it, actually. Mm-hmm. And it had to be plants that could grow under the power lines. And so off to the edges of the power lines, we planted some pawpaw trees, mm-hmm. And a few apple trees. But some native species like chokeberry, beech plum, and lots of hazelnuts. Mm. And some hazelnuts from Mark Shepherd's breeding project.
Oh, wow.
The other thing I wanted to mention briefly is that I know there's a wonderful author named Diana Beresford Kroger. And recently she's been strongly advocating for planting hickory trees. And at Nauset Middle School, where I work, teaching sixth graders and eighth graders, we've started to grow shellbark hickory and shagbark hickory trees.
Oh,
so
great.
That's another connection to the nut crops.
Yeah.
We've lost hickory trees here on Cape Cod, and so that's an experiment with trying to get them back.
Rand, thanks for sharing that, and good luck with that. Thank you so much. That's good to know that that's out there. And since Rand, talking about that, one of the things you point to in the book, monoculture required 60 times more resources than the polyculture to produce the same amount of output. And one of the fascinating farms, the Wall Farm, right? I mean, the 100 over 100% yield. How is that even possible?
Well, yes, over 100% yield. And I just want to say thank you, Rand, for calling. It's always so good to hear from you. And I want to hear more about the hickories. But the over 100% yield, you know, when we're talking about yield from a monoculture, yield is a ratio, and we're usually not counting all of what has to go in to get what you get out. So if we're serious about land being this limiting factor, right, you got to count all the land that it takes to produce the yield on any given acre. And so on the Wall Farm, they weren't using all these inputs from other places, right? They were producing most of what they need right there on that same land. And so if they had 100% yield from the chestnuts, but were also growing, you know, under that, they have pawpaws as an understory tree, which he says were getting about 50% of what they could get if they were just grown on their own in full sun. So you've got 100% from the nut trees, 50% from the pawpaws, and then they were also raising sheep under there for food. So then you're also getting that sheep yield. And I think that that's why a monoculture can never compete with a polyculture, because with a monoculture, even if you're getting 100% yield, you're really only tapping into one layer and one species. And what a polyculture can do is provide yield from all these different layers.
Oh, fascinating. All right, let's talk to Sandy, who's giving us a call from Providence. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you? Nice to talk to you today. I'm listening for the first time, so it's very interesting.
Yeah. Did you have a question or a comment? Yeah, go ahead.
I had a comment.
Okay.
So I grew up on a farm in Connecticut, close to the New York border, and we had about 100 acres, and we would plant, you know, the little trees and, you know, the seedlings and weed the rows and so forth. But what our parents let us do is we used to go down the way to the cattle farms. There was horses and cows all around us, and there were chestnut trees, and they were as big as, like you said, like 2 feet in the dirt in the fall. Mm-hmm. And we would pick those, and we and our parents would tell us stories about the Great Depression and how that, you know, that's when the blight came, and that they, you know, you could make money from picking the chestnuts and bringing them to the country store. So we as kids made money doing that, you know, until we moved to Rhode Island.
Yeah. Wow.
And so those must have been hybrid or Chinese trees, I would imagine, if they were still producing after the blight.
Right.
Well, didn't some survive the blight?
Sometimes they do. They get to be about 15, 20 years old, and then they'll succumb back to the blight, but send up a new shoot.
Yeah. These trees were enormous. I mean, I'm in my 60s, and I was there as a kid, and they were so big, these trees. Yeah. And they were scattered between the farmland. So, and again, it wasn't fenced, so we could go there because we weren't kept out, you know, because it wasn't fenced. You could go and you could forage and get the chestnuts and bring them to the country store. It was like a nice way to grow up.
I say, make a little dough. Sandy, thanks for sharing that story. And that was what happened after the blight, though, right? Is they replaced the American chestnut with these other.
Yeah, well, they tried to introduce the Chinese. So the blight came here from Asia on imported Asian trees. So the Chinese chestnuts and the Japanese chestnuts have co-evolved with this blight. So they have a lot of different sources of resistance, but the American trees had never encountered the blight and didn't have resistance. So after the blight moved through, some communities tried to replace what they had lost with these blight-resistant Asiatic trees. And I think in some communities, you know, maybe people would have one tree outside their house, but they didn't, in Appalachia in particular, they didn't really catch on. The Park Service planted a huge stand of Chinese chestnuts in one area that I visited. And I think the nuts were different. They're bigger. They don't have the same flavor as the American nuts. But they're also, I think, they need to be tended. So they don't have the same timber form as the American tree. The Chinese ones are shorter and more of an orchard tree. And I think there was this sense of they didn't fit into the forest in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go back to fire now, because later now you tagged along for prescribed burn on Cape Cod and you found the annual fires were the reason there were not many oak trees, right, in this area, contradictory to what you thought about them needing fire. So you're like, wait, what? So tell us about that.
Well, yeah, and I should back that up a little to say, obviously, we have tons of oaks in our area.
In that area, right.
Yeah, I went on a prescribed burn where it's about a mile from my house in Wellfleet on the Truro Line, where Dave Crary, who's an amazing guy, has been the fire management officer for the Cape Cod National Seashore until a few years ago when he retired. And they were trying to understand what different fire regimes do to the forest here. And so they were burning in different plots, either annually, every 2 years, every 3 years, or every 4 years. And what they found is that if you burn every year, that's a little too frequently to maintain an oak forest. You'll have a cleared patch of land.
Right.
And so what I took away from that was the importance of nuance when you're trying to understand how to take care of a place, and especially the relationship between humans and fire and different plant species. Ron Reed had told me that in California, the fire return interval, which is a really common word in prescribed and cultural fire, that's how often you want to put fire on a landscape to maintain a given plant community. You know, in some places, and even in a given place, it might depend on the micro ecosystem, mm-hmm. right? In a wetter area, maybe you want it a little less frequently. In a drier area, maybe a little more frequently, depending on what you're trying to produce on the landscape. So what I found when I started looking into the traditional fire return interval on the Cape, because Indigenous people here burned us also and still do. And the fire return interval over a lot of the Northeast for maintaining oak trees is a lot of burning for maybe 10 years to create this oak regeneration, because oaks can outcompete other species with frequent burning. They have this deep root system and this ability to resprout. And then a break from fire for a few decades.
Yeah.
So it's nuanced.
Oh, so that whole nuance is so fascinating.
Yeah,
right?
It's really complicated.
All right. In your chapter on nuts in the kitchen, you look at the many ways that they're used or prepared. And in here, you talk a lot about getting the tannins out of the acorns. And you even gave an example of you tried to do this, and where some of them you didn't have to use as much flushing or washing, these other ones you just could not seem to get them because they turned out to be a different species. And who knows? There's like a lot of different species of oak.
Yeah, you might imagine that when you're talking about an acorn, we're all talking about the same thing. But as I started to talk to people in different places, I was talking to people in Greece, in present-day California, in Wisconsin, in all these different places, I realized pretty quickly that we weren't always talking about the same thing. There's more than 600 species of oaks, and they all have slightly different nuts. And the tannins leach differently out of different species. So there's and you know, oaks are a bit promiscuous, so they can hybridize. So even if you think you know the species you're dealing with,
you might not.
Okay. And again, that's really place-specific knowledge and requires getting to know the area where you are and really experimenting.
Yeah. All right. The biggest surprise in the book. All right. First of all, I was surprised about you could eat acorns, but here's the biggest surprise in the book for me. You write, Haslett Marquin picked a pair of dry, yellowing husks filled with rounded brown shells, opened them, and handed me a hazelnut, popping the other into his mouth. They're edible straight off the tree. You don't even have to roast them, he said, cracking the shell open with his molars. And I believe that the amount of nutrition in these things, if you eat nuts, you don't need to eat vegetables. What? You don't need to. I really never thought 92% of vegetables is water and no essential oil. So tell us about this. You can eat nuts and not have to eat vegetables. I think there's some kids who are going, wait, what?
Well, he was mostly joking, but there are, I think his point was really not that we shouldn't eat vegetables, because vegetables, in addition to being nutritious, are also very delicious. But his point was that nuts are nutrition powerhouses. You know, we're always hearing that we should eat more nuts. Most of us ignore this advice. but nuts have some pretty great things in them for our health.
Tell us.
Yeah, so they're full of B vitamins, which are really important for our health. And they're also preventative of heart disease. So a lot of the diet-related diseases that we struggle with today come in sort of this cluster. So, you know, heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, often these are correlated and are diet-related. And as people have moved away from whole grains and whole nuts, so I don't want to throw grains under the table because whole grains and whole nuts actually have a lot of the same really important dietary components. But unfortunately, what we're eating now is a lot of refined grains and sugar.
Yeah.
And so one thing I think to think about if people are moving toward more nuts is how we process them and how we treat them, because that really makes a nutritional difference.
So what are your thoughts on the, so you did this journey, you found out we could be making this staple food to feed a lot more people. Do you think it will actually happen? I mean, that's a lot of politics involved in farming. So what do you think?
I think it's up to us. I think it depends on what we decide. And I think that, you know, we have a lot of environmental decisions where right now where we can sort of wait for the ecosystem to force us to do something, or we could get ahead of it and make the choice ourselves to try to move in a different direction.
So now, after all of this that you've learned, are you incorporating more nuts in your family's diet?
Yeah, I've been playing around a lot and it's been really fun. I collected a lot of red oak acorns from Maine last fall because I hadn't worked as much with those. And I've been making flour. There are some acorns that you can make oil out of. It makes this incredible, like, amber, orange, kind of sunset-colored oil with property really similar to olive oil. And there has been a forager in the Midwest who's producing that for sale. So I've been experimenting with that a little bit and having a lot of fun with that. And I've been working a lot with chestnuts as well. I've been playing with some chestnut flour crackers, chestnut flour crepes, like a savory crepe where you saute mushrooms and greens and chopped up chestnuts and put a little dollop of ricotta. Those are really good. And what else have I been making? Substituting both acorn and chestnut flour make great substitutes for corn flour.
Anywhere
you would use cornmeal or corn flour, you can often substitute those.
And then also I noticed you took a twig class, twig weaving.
Yes.
Making baskets as well.
Yeah, when I was on the Klamath with Ron Reed, a friend of his, Kathy McCovey, was making these beautiful hazelnut baskets and talked to me a bit about the importance of fire in managing hazelnuts and oaks, not just as food sources, but also as basketry resources, because a lot of these nut trees like to be cut back and they like to be managed either with fire or with being pruned back. And then they send up this flush of new growth, which produces more nuts when they're being maintained that way, and also produces these twigs for basketry. So I started taking some classes, but there were no hazelnut or oak classes around where I was. So I've been learning with Willow and have gone deep down that rabbit hole. So maybe that's the next book. I don't know.
All right, the book is Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. And I imagine in weeks to come, we might hear more in the food report on some of these nut recipes and things and how to grow them, right? Elspeth Hay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.